is time to put away the bias, the lies, and deceit and bring forth real talk from real people about real news. Providing the out loud truth and capturing the essence of a new generation all in a fast-paced hour. This is Viewpoint This Sunday.
America, land of opportunity, home of the free. Are we still a free country? Are we still what our founders gave us? We are here in 2021. Are we safe? Are we free? Immigrants like my parents came to this nation to escape socialism. Many came from countries with oligarchies or monarchs or dictators to try this new concept, a constitutional republic. And welcome to this week's Viewpoint, the news magazine on America Out Loud. I'm Tim Alders, covering for Malcolm. Our first guest this hour will be Lyle Bear. He is the vice president at the Thomas Jefferson Center for Constitutional Studies. The second guest will be Brian Hyde, long-term radio host, constitutional conservative, protector of the Constitution, almost as long as me, and a longtime good friend. The Anti-Federalist Papers, because everybody says we're a constitutional republic, but are we? This is a question we're going to answer today, and the guest today is Lyle Bear. He is a vice president with the Thomas Jefferson Constitutional Center. Did I get that right? I probably butchered it already from the start.
Thomas Jefferson Center for Constitutional Studies.
Good, good. Now, Lyle, one of the things that's been troubling me lately is, you know, I see a lot of people posting the Federalist Papers in support of the Bill of Rights and everything like that. But we wouldn't have even got a Bill of Rights if it wasn't for the Anti-Federalists.
That's very true. There were those that did not want to sign the Constitution on September 17th, 1787, because they were afraid of this national government becoming too powerful. And so they had some real concerns about what they were putting in that Constitution. And most of it was alleviated when they put in the Bill of Rights.
Now, the Anti-Federalist Papers, what they call them, aren't exactly the same writing style. They weren't published at the time to try and get people to ratify the Constitution, which is what Hamilton and them wanted to do. It's basically 30 documents that came from the Federal Convention of 1787. The arguments that people like John Rutledge and Sherman and Jerry and Randolph and James Wilson and James Madison were flat out not going to sign the Constitution or have their states ratify it.
Well, that's true. I don't know near as much about the Anti-Federalist Papers. I do have a copy of it here, and I have read probably several of them, but I've read more of the Federalist Papers themselves,
too. And everybody in America has. And this is why I want to educate people on the Anti-Federalist Papers, because what has hurt America the most are two amendments in my eyes. The 17th Amendment that created the loss of the 10th Amendment.
Absolutely. I think the one thing that a lot of people do not understand is that the last amendment passed supersedes everything in front of it that they can make anything to do with it. And so, yeah, 17 has superseded the first 10 even.
And the 10th Amendment was Madison's. I mean, everybody loves the First Amendment, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, the Second Amendment, you know, right to keep and bear arms. But the 10th Amendment was supposed to be the ultimate checks and balance on the federal government growing too strong. And that is why it was such a passion for Madison, because Madison was terrified that we would basically elect a king and the royal cabinet around the king in the central location for the federal government. At that time, they didn't know where it was going to be. So it's Washington, D.C. now. But what is happening today is in direct result of the 17th Amendment taking away states' rights. And people don't realize it was planned. It was orchestrated to do exactly that, to make the federal government stronger and weaken the states.
That's right. That 17th Amendment, people do not understand that because of it, the states cannot protect them or their families anymore.
Much of the argument that they had at the Constitutional Convention was based on, okay, how do we put checks and balances? How do we make sure the people, this is the people's government, how do we make sure states have a say? How do we make sure that we don't have a king? They did this, so they gave the people the house. That's why it's called the people's house. They gave the people the house, right. And it was based on population. Then there was a large debate on how many senators to make, and some of these anti-federalists only wanted small states. Well, some of the federalists only wanted small states to have one and large states to have multiple. And the argument from Madison and the anti-federalists is like the large states could end up with 80 while we have one based on population. And then the state really has no say anyway. So they came to the terms of two per state.
Correct. House and the Senate, people need to understand how they were to work together. In the Federalist Papers, they do talk about how if one state could see that its rights were being taken away, the idea was that all the rest of them would jump together and have their senators vote so that they could protect those state rights.
And you can find a lot about the electing of representatives and the debate on the method of electing senators in Anti-Federalist Papers 7 and 8. But one other founding father that many people mention, and a lot of people put him in the Federalist side without really realizing that Benjamin Franklin was an anti-Federalist. Benjamin Franklin argued against paying an executive salary to these people who served from states and for Congress and the people. He didn't want anybody to be paid because wealth leads to corruption, and we've seen that today.
Right. He thought paying these guys was totally immoral. And we can see with 2020 hindsight that this is absolutely what has happened. That it's not that their morality has changed so much as money makes them make different decisions than they would otherwise.
So a large part of the argument that the anti-federalists were making about the senators being elected by the people, because the federalists, like Hamilton, wanted the people to vote for both. And when the 17th Amendment came about, they said, oh, don't you think you should have a say and not your state? But the whole point of the matter is the anti-federalists recognized that people would get lazy. And that they would have one house to be lazy in because that house was a 2-year term. And the house that was the 6-year term, the state could get fed up with their senator and recall them and pull them out. And they never wanted a senator serving 48 years in the U.S. Senate. But because of the 17th Amendment, states can't recall senators. There is no provision to get rid of a senator anywhere in the Constitution.
That's true. The power has been taken away from each of the state houses of Congress, the Senate, as well as the representatives in the state assemblies. They were at one time to appoint them, and if they didn't like what they were, the decisions that they were making, they could vote them out next time. There was a provision in the Constitution where they could recall them, but that wasn't exactly what they intended to do. But after 6 years, they could recall them through election in particular. And that was what the 17th Amendment took away from the state legislatures.
So I mentioned some names of some of the lesser known founding fathers. You had Sherman was opposed to, and in Anti-Federalist Paper 3, let me make sure, yes, 3, see, I have it right, May 31st, he talked about, he was even opposed to the people being involved with electing the House. And his argument, really, if you look at it in today's world with the Senate and the 10th Amendment, he said the people, he said, immediately should have as little to do with government. They want information and they're constantly liable to be misled. That people are so easily fooled by what's printed in a newspaper and they don't really know what's going on. So they wanted them with little involvement. Now, Mr. Jerry said in that same document, the evils we experience flow from the excess of a democracy. we're becoming too much of a democracy with this Constitution. The people do not want virtue, but are duped by pretended patriots. He talked about in Massachusetts, where he was from, that they have confirmed faults, designing men with principles of evil and with power to rule over people. And so he was terrified that it would happen, that the people wouldn't pay attention, would be misled by people who blatantly lie to him. And then Mr. Mason argued strongly for the election of the larger branch by the people. It was to be the grand depository of the democratic principle of the government. The House of Commons, it was going to be, in comparison to what the King of England had, the House of Commons, where this is where the common people had a voice. So that was the counter argument that Mr. Mason proposed, is, yeah, we need a house for the people as long as we have a house for the state. And now we have neither.
Right. That was part of the great compromise that they came up with, two houses, and they each had veto power over each other. And they could both also veto the president, in effect, if they got two thirds of them together, which in our day and age, that'll probably never happen, not for a long time anyway. And so it's important for us to understand that this Constitution that they gave us was a combination of a republic and a democracy. And that's why they came up with the Electoral College. They knew that people would be totally emotionally driven in who they voted for. And so they wanted to avoid that at every turn. And
part of the reason I love reading the Anti-Federalist Papers and the debate that happened during the Constitutional Convention is most of the warnings about where we're at today actually came from the Anti-Federalists.
True.
The Federalists had more faith in the people, the population. You know, they just fought a war. They just got their independence. They thought people would continue to sacrifice and pay attention to their government, which dwindled off over time. And the Anti-Federalists were saying, no, that's not going to happen. Trust me. These people are going to get tired. They're going to get lazy. They're just going to vote. And they were opposed. They wanted the state to run both because they said this would happen. But the compromise, like you said, came when the Anti-Federalists agreed, okay, then we'll do senators. And that came later in the debate, where they made the Senate from the state, so there was balance. But the whole point was is that the people, based on a population, would be more powerful than the state. And so they created that balance that, okay, even though California or Texas could, and I use the Democratic and Republican state, see, I'm not, even though they'll have massive populations and they'll have more people in America's House of Commons in the democracy portion of this country, we're still going to be a republic because we're balanced out by the Senate and the state. So even though they might be able to urbanize their cities and want free things from government, we'll always have the state and the senators being able to say no. And with the 17th Amendment, we lost that authority.
Absolutely. Plus, with the combination of the 17th and the 16th Amendment, the states lost the power to have control over the federal budget. And so with that 16th Amendment in there, they were, before the 16th Amendment, the states were supposed to be able to be the ones that came up with the federal budget according to their proportion of the entire population, and they lost it. And so between those two amendments, we've come a long way down the path to socialism and to the problems we have in our country right now.
And if you look at these debates from the Anti-Federalist perspective, and the next paper is the fourth, which is the debate on the executive, and with the executive orders and the executive branches of the government, how they've exploded that with amendments after the 10th to give the executive so much power. You know, you had Mr. Wilson move that the executive only ever consists of a single person. You never have a cabinet. It's just one person, and that they extend to peace and war is what Mr. Pinckney said. You know, okay, if we're going to do this, then we need to read that a national executive to consist of a single pawn be instituted. A considerable pause ensuing, and the chairman asking if he should put the question. And then Franklin observed that it was a point of great importance, and the executive was critical that they didn't make a monarch, that they didn't give a king who could sign into law without going through Congress, without going through the House of Commons, which is the people's house here, our Congress, and the Senate, which is the state, that they would be checked by the state and the people, and that there would be balance. And if the state and people couldn't agree, there just would be no law. And see, that was the problem up until the 17th Amendment, is they couldn't pass these stupid things to tax people. They couldn't pass these things to fund and to borrow money beyond their point. And so, like, let's get rid of the state. And so there will just be a popular vote, and we can influence the vote with money. And then all these people will be wanting to spend more money. They can be more corrupt.
That's true. In the course of this conversation, we want you to understand that those of us at the Thomas Jefferson Center, though, are very pleased with the Constitution as it came out, but it's with what Jefferson said, we need to keep the people awake. We need to keep them involved. We need to have strong local self-government. And it all, they wanted the local government to be much stronger than the national government.
They did. And I quote Mr. Sherman a lot. I love Sherman's writing. Sherman wrote some amazing things, but he said he considered the executive magistracy as nothing more than an institution for carrying out the will of the legislature into effect, not being an independent entity, not being able to sign executive orders, not being able to do any of that. And that was the intent that came out of the Constitutional Convention. Because they ruled on Sherman's motion that, yeah, the executive should only be the person to sign into law, but then be the check on the House and the Senate. If it violates the federal power, he could say no. And then the people in the state can override that and say, no, you can't say no. And then you'd have the Supreme Court that would say, okay, this is all unconstitutional.
Right. Remember when they passed Obamacare and they... Nancy Pelosi had the audacity to say that we have to pass the law in order to understand what's in the law. And she was absolutely correct in that, because as soon as they passed the law, they gave it to all the agencies and bureaus, and they came up with multitudes of laws that the Congress did not necessarily put in there. And so the number of pages of the law that the Congress passed went from like 2,700 pages to 67,000 pages. And so now the bureaus and agencies can be the judge, jury, and executioner, and we don't have to have any of the Bill of Rights in order for them to do things that are really detrimental to people.
It's true. And Mr. Wilson closed out the debate on the executive, I think, in perfect thing. He said that unity in the executive, instead of being the fetus of monarchy, would be the best safeguard against tyranny if the executive had no power but to institute what the legislator put forth.
Right.
And I summarize, it's a little longer than that and a little different wordage, but that's basically what Mr. Wilson said on the debate of the executive. Is the executive is basically there to serve at the will and be the people's last protector and bring to law what the Congress does, but never create law himself, because once an executive starts to create law, he becomes a monarch.
Right. And so basically in conclusion, then, we need to understand that the Constitution was put together to protect the individual and the family, and the state had that greater responsibility in doing that. And with the 16th and 17th Amendments, it's all been taken away.
And the interesting thing, that the whole thing about the 10th Amendment and why Madison wanted the 10th Amendment was there, is because they felt that the federal government would eventually try to overreach its authority. And anything that wasn't in Section 1, 8 of the Constitution, an enumerated power to Congress, was left to the state and the people. So if Congress ever did anything that wasn't there, then they can veto it. Now, government got around that by every amendment past the 11th by adding powers, which Congress should have never been able to add powers to the federal government. It was never intended that way. Usurpation.
Yeah, they did it by usurpation instead of amendment.
Almost every amendment after the 14th and 17th came after they got rid of the Senate being a state representation.
Right.
And they took away the state's voice. So how can we as citizens save anything of our republic? And, you know, people get irritated with constitutionalists saying we're a constitutional republic. No, we were based on a democracy. No, there's only one aspect of our government that was basically based on a democracy, and it had so many checks to protect the democracy from growing. And yet everybody just violates that concept and that principle.
Well, the best thing that we can do is we have not been educated on the Constitution for years. And so to gain an understanding of how the Constitution works, that is what we need to do, is rejuvenate that idea and help people understand it. It's a great document. It needs to be having educated people in order to make it work, though, properly.
I don't know if you were in your era, in your part of the country you were growing up, but in mine, I was taught that the Anti-Federalists were radicals, that they were, you know, opposed to everything that the government was trying to do. Yet, if you actually research history, and schools never taught the Anti-Federalist Papers, they always mentioned the Federalist Papers when I was a kid a little bit, touched on them a little bit, but the Anti-Federalist Papers brought the balance. If it wasn't for the compromise between Anti-Federalists and Federalists, and you said it earlier, there was a lot of headbutting. These people didn't get along on all these topics.
Patrick Henry was a great patriot, but he definitely was not a Federalist. He was an Anti-Federalist through and through.
And that's what people don't realize. There were some big names that were Anti-Federalist.
You bet. And that was why the debates for the ratification conventions were so close in their votes in a lot of places, is because they were well-educated people that could see the need for that. But, you know, we need to keep the whole thing in people's law in the center of the spectrum and keep it away from tyranny on one side and anarchy on the other side.
So I really want people to read those 30 documents called the Anti-Federalist Papers, and they're hard to find.
They are.
You can Google it, but one of the final debates as the Constitutional Convention was wrapping up, Mason, Randolph, and Gerry spoke on the opposition to the Constitution. Even after all the compromises were made, Colonel Mason still didn't like the vice president. He said, "The office of vice president is an encroachment on the rights of the Senate, and that it mixed too much of the legislative and executive. By appointing a vice president the head of the Senate, if there's a tie, it brings the legislative will out of it and puts the executive will into it." He took occasion to express the dislike of any reference whatsoever to the power to make appointments to either branch of the legislature by the executive or governors without state legislators doing it. Randolph took the opportunity to put the objections to the whole system. They turned on the Senate being made the court of impeachment for trying the executive on the necessity of three quarters instead of two thirds. He wanted it to be easier to get rid of an executive if the power grew too much. And then Mr. Randolph, commenting on the indefinite and dangerous power given by the Constitution to Congress, expressing the pain he felt from the body of the convention on the close of the great and awful subject of their labors. He really wanted term limits. He didn't trust the people would do term limits. And Colonel Mason seconded and followed Randolph in that. And then Gerry spoke. It's just, you know, everybody says that the Constitution has term limits based on the vote of the people. Well, the 17th Amendment came about because those corrupt people who wanted socialism in our nation knew that the will of the people would be just to leave people there and not be involved. And they're so easily misled, more so than a state. So they were just opposed to having anybody be able to get reelected. Unfortunately, that never made it into the final draft of the Constitution.
Yeah, the anti-federalists understood human nature very well and how lazy we are in keeping up with what they are working on in Congress. Even today, it's the same way. And that's one of the reasons they wanted so much to have a strong local self-government. And today we've got self-government by the local people, but they're being manipulated and funded in many cases by the national or state governments, and it's and even manipulated by the UN.
And George Washington had spoke in closing arguments that we really had to make sure we didn't fall under the control of foreign nations, that we were supposed to be that beacon of light. At the ratification of the Constitution, there was an added what they call 17 anti-federalist papers. And that's the speech of James Wilson on October 6th, John DeWitt's essays on October 27th. He did essay one, essay two, which was two and three of those. Patrick Henry's speech on June 5th, amendments proposed by the Massachusetts Convention. So the whole state got together and said, this is what we want in the Bill of Rights. The ones proposed by the Virginia Conventions. Amendments to the Constitution, how they came about, the ones proposed by Rhode Island, and then the speech by Patrick Henry again on June 7th. So the states that were having a hard time ratifying the Constitution wanted to make sure certain amendments were in there. And there were more amendments done than were actually put into the Constitution, correct?
Correct. When all the states had the opportunity to put in their recommendations, I believe there was 189 of them. And Madison got them all down to 12, and only 10 of them were ratified by the states.
And if you read Madison's letters to Jefferson from the Library of Congress during the amendment period, which basically went up to 1788, he basically said he doubts the population would ever be so stupid to give up unalienable rights that are so easily known. And if they put in these 10 and limit government with Section 1, Article 8 of the Constitution, that we'd be protected. I sometimes wish every amendment that they proposed ended up in there, the Bill of Rights, because it spelled out everything that anybody argues about. And this is my big bug that just bothers me. It's like an insect that just keeps bugging around me and buzzing, is that it's not hard for the Supreme Court to say what the intent of the founders were if they just look at those original amendments, everything that was proposed.
Right. Don't you think, though, that a lot of this is because we have kicked God out of the equation? And we're supposed to self-govern ourselves according to his rules. And because we aren't, we have to have all these other rules, and people are manipulating the whole thing because they're throwing God out of the formula.
I agree, Lyle. It's been a pleasure to have you on the show today. I urge people to go and read everything about the Founding Fathers. Look at how they formulated the Constitution. Look what their intent was. Don't let CNN, MSNBC, or even Fox News tell you the intention of the Founding Fathers without reading their own words, because they were all well-documented people. And right. We miss so much. Everybody quotes Jefferson, and everybody quotes, you know, John Adams, and everybody quotes Franklin, which is surprising. But they don't quote Sherman, and they don't quote Randolph and Dickerson and George Reed and Jerry and these people that were really concerned with a centralized government assuming too much power.
Right. And one of the best ways to catch the balance of everything is to read the Making of America. You know, W. Cleon Skousen wrote that Making of America, and he gave quotes from all of these guys because that was part of how they put it together and why they ended up with the way it was.
That's a little easier than looking it up the way I do, going to the Library of Congress, pulling up their name and researching every documented film that they've put on these people. And we'll put that on the link to this show on advertisements. Thanks so much for joining us, and
You're
have
welcome.
A great rest of your day.
Okay, thank you.
The America Out Loud Talk Radio app is on Android or Apple. It's the perfect way to listen in to the new generation of talk shows and hosts who are ready to inform and inspire.
Now, never before in our history have we witnessed the level of hatred that is now being waged against our law enforcement. While anarchist groups create havoc and overwhelm our first responders, these same groups and their corporate supporters are calling for the police forces to be shrunk and defunded. What can you and I do to make a difference? How can we stand up for what is right and to show our support? That's what I'm going to tell you about this incredible new platform. It's called ShopToTheRight.com. And it's a new shopping platform that will help you find businesses that align with your values. They feature products made in America. They support veteran-owned businesses as well as our law enforcement community. This is a time when we need to stick together, we need to shop together, and we need to support each other. It's time for you and I to make some noise and stand up to protect our country. And one easy way to do that is to shop and give our money to companies that don't seek to destroy our way of life. So join the fight for liberty. ShopToTheRight.com. Support those American businesses that support law enforcement and veterans.
AmericaOutloud.com is the voice of liberty and justice for all. Well, Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech, canceling any of the freedoms that our Constitution guarantees is not an option. 5 years on the air, and we will not be silenced. America Out Loud Talk Radio. It's a fight for the soul of humanity.
Welcome back to Viewpoint this Sunday. We're talking Constitution today, and in order to do so, I brought on a good friend with me. He's almost as big a nerd as me. You know, our Constitution started with the Articles of the Confederation, and then we did the Declaration of Independence, and then we went on to the Constitution, and everybody's familiar with the Federalist Papers. Not many are as familiar with the Anti-Federalist Papers, which actually gave us the Bill of Rights. James Madison was an Anti-Federalist, and many people don't understand that. We discussed a little bit of this the first time, but Brian, you, like me, we have studied the Constitution from beginning to end with all the letters. What made you decide to study the Constitution?
I think what made the connection for me was when I made the connection that liberty and God were actually not mutually exclusive concepts. When I saw, thanks to David Barton and Wall Builders, I saw America's godly heritage. And that was the first time in my life that not just appreciation for liberty, but love of liberty, love of the Constitution, and recognition of God's hand in the founding of this nation really came home for me. And my life was never the same after that.
I think in today's world, if we would have stuck to the Constitution and our constitutional republic the way it was meant, and you can find out that for yourself, and I urge you, Wall Builders, David Barton, like you said, Hillsdale College, there's a lot of resources out there to learn the Constitution. But I found the only way I could learn the Constitution is not other people telling me about the Constitution like we're doing to you today, but to actually, that's why I give you the resources, where I get it, where to find it. Library of Congress, go look up these people. Look up every of the 55 signers and see what role God played. Don't trust the media who says they're deists. Go research it for yourself. Don't trust anybody. Look into it and do it. But, you know, the Constitution was so critical for America, and if we would have stuck to the principles, stuck to the 10th Amendment, listened to the warnings of the anti-federalists, I don't think we'd have such hate and division in the nation that we have today. And it's one of the reasons you're getting tired of politics and I'm getting tired of politics, because America was never meant to be based on politics and corruption. It was meant to be based on government from the people down, and everybody has the same fair shot and same opportunity.
Yeah, when you look at world history, it's pretty plain that the times and places where liberty has been the condition of a people, you know, a given time and place, it almost never lasts for long. And when we get right down to it, it's a very rare thing. I think Dr. Harold Pease likens it to, it's like getting a butterfly to come and land on you. Only people who are doing the right thing are going to get that butterfly to even come near them in the first place. And the ones who can get it to stay are the ones who are truly doing the right thing. Freedom is very much that same way. And to the extent that that our society has come adrift from those foundational principles and practices, you know, we've likewise seen our culture, our country, our ship of state drift to places it was never intended to go.
When we look at the corruption, and everybody, what's really weird is whenever they do any poll in this land, they say Congress is corrupt. 97% of the people agree Congress, and that is the House and the Senate, are so corrupt, and they've been bought by special interests, and they don't have people's good intentions and goodwill at heart. You know, they have they care about the money makers, the corporations, everything else. When you look at the original Constitution, that was never meant to be. We weren't supposed to have all the laws we have in America today, or even on the state level, because even on state level, we have a House that's the people and we have a House that's a Senate, but they're both actually elected by the people. But it's supposed to give balance, and there's no balance anywhere from government. What our nation is missing right now is balance and adult conversation.
Well, and you look at Washington, D.C. right now. I had the chance to interview a young man who lives in the D.C. area earlier this week. And I asked him, well, what's it like there? I said, I see the pictures. I see the barbed wire and the fences and soldiers. And he said, that's not the worst part. He said, the worst part is everything is so silent right now. Normally, this is a bustling city and there's people. I mean, there's protesters for this or protesters for that. But there are people engaging and there are people living life. Not now. It's very quiet because it's quiet like, you know, a prison. It's locked down.
A lot of people look at what's going on in this nation, and those people are called conservatives, unfortunately, Christians, you know, evangelicals. They label us a lot of different things. We're people who care about the economy. We're people who care about our country. We're people who care about God, so we pay attention. And we don't just buy the 5-minute news feed off of CNN or MSNBC or even Fox News. But you look at what's happening with, you need a driver's license to drive. You need permits to cut hair. But you don't need an ID or any kind of registration to vote. And that's how a corrupt system works, because then you can manipulate the vote.
Well, and here's something else to think about, too. Corrupt systems, they have elections, too. But people's choices are very, very limited by the system itself. And I'm just throwing this out there. When you, if you were to visit another country and you were to roll up to their capital and it were to be a bustling place where people are coming and going and, you know, you actually have some freedom of movement, you would probably draw some conclusions about what the state of affairs was like in that country. On the other hand, if you went up there and it was locked down and there were mean looking guys with guns standing everywhere staring at you and mean mugging you, you'd probably draw some conclusions there about how that government views its citizens versus the one where people are actually, you know, considered part of it. They're part of the process and not, you know, some enemy.
We almost feel like it's not part of the process anymore because, you know, the people's house is no longer the people's house. It's a fortified compound that the people aren't allowed into anymore, which is totally insane. But as we look at the world in general, the country my parents came from was Holland. All these socialist European nations changed because of America. They changed their economies a little bit. They went more towards freedom because America was so successful and they were losing citizens. Citizens are wanting to leave, so they had to give them a little bit of freedom. So it's no shock to me that everybody in the world is happy that America is starting to lose our constitutional republic and go more towards socialism, because then they can get back to a world dominated by rulers who know better for your life than you do.
Yeah. And that was the whole key of the system that the founders gave us, was it was a system that didn't rely on someone choosing for you what was best and what was the highest priority of your life. And that's the one we've lost track of. The founders, as you were mentioning, Tim, were very well schooled in history. They understood human nature and the timeless truths that applied to the way that they set up that system of governance, to where the federal government had very few limited powers. The state governments would handle things that were closer to the people, but the people were expected largely to govern themselves. That is now lost, in the sense that we've forgotten what the principles were that they were looking to that informed the way that they put that all together.
Now, most of the founding fathers served in the British Army. Most of the founders were very loyal to the court until the French and Indian War ended. When the French and Indian War ended and England thought that they should be able to tax the colonies more because it was fought here, and that the colony had to pay for all this taxes and they had to take it out of everything and any goods that came from England, they just jetted up the price. And the colonists started looking at it as, we are an economic resource. Yet we don't have representation on the King's Court, the House of Commons. We have no say in our own lives, and we want that. And that's what started the discussion of freedom. And I look at today and I look at all the taxes we have and I look at all the regulations and everything that's going on, and King George would have been proud.
Yeah, I think even King George would be amazed at the lengths to which government has begun to impose itself on us. I mean, one of the distinctive complaints that the colonists listed out in the Declaration of Independence was, he hath erected offices and sent hither swarms of officers to eat out our substance. And you could describe a lot of federal programs that do exactly that, you know, where you've got EPA inspectors and you've got, you know, every federal agency has its own SWAT team now. That's one explanation. But even down to the local level, you see government moving beyond its proper role. Code enforcement officers are sent out there to find reasons to write people up. And, you know, again, who represents the person in that equation? The code enforcement person's there on the behalf of the government, the municipality, the state.
I remember when Daniel Boone was serving in the legislature. One of my favorite stories was when the fires hit. And the legislature was talking about bailing it out, and Daniel Boone was in a walk in his district, and somebody walked up and he said, "Hey, I've always supported you. I've always liked you, but why should I pay for fires that happened somewhere else? You know, you could come back to your area and ask for donations, but I should have to give it freely. You shouldn't have to take it. You shouldn't determine that I should pay for a fire in another state, hundreds of miles away, that would take me days on a horse to get to, yet I can't feed my neighbor because you took the money to give to somebody else." And he reflected and saw that, wow, government's already at that point getting overreaching in America. And we look at it and people say, well, what's the harm of licensing a barber? Don't you want a good haircut? Well, I'll tell you what, if somebody tries to become a barber and hangs out a barber shop, you know, the little spinny thing with the red and white, and they do a bad job, nobody's going to go there anyway. So it's sort of self-regulating business, and that's the intentions, but that's not where we're at.
No, and what you're describing is a perfect example of when government or people acting on behalf of government think that they can substitute their judgment, like a one-size-fits-all judgment, for everybody. Tim, you know what kind of barber would give you a haircut that you would be willing to pay for and you'd be willing to wear, you know, for the next couple of weeks. The government doesn't need to step in and license people. In fact, more often than not, that licensure just becomes a barrier to entry for new barbers or new people, new entrepreneurs who want to enter the market. So it's well-intended, but it still also has some unintended consequences that always end up costing people work, costing them opportunity, or just simply costing more for whatever it is they're paying for.
One of the big debates when it comes to the Constitution, when it comes to the role of government, is government looks at the Constitution as a contract. But anything you read from the founders, it was a compact. It was an agreement to join as colonies to help fend off foreign powers, because at that time you had England, you had France. If you didn't join these 13 colonies, they would invade and take over one at a time, and French would own half, and England would own half, and who knows, the Dutch Indies would, East Indian Trading Company would have came in and owned. But it was for a safety reason. But America has spoken, our government has spoken many, many times on overthrowing governments. And there's no need for Russia to be the bloc, the Soviet bloc. Remember the Soviet bloc? And there's no need. So we let them all go into separate states. And that's how you came up with the Ukraine and Poland and Czechoslovakia and all these countries gain their independence and their own government. I think America's gone past the point of our compact. And a lot of people might think that sounds crazy, but we live in a world today where nobody is empire building, except maybe China. We don't know about China, but nobody's really empire building. And if we split into two, we'd still be strong enough because the left don't want a military. So we'd have it and let them be conquered.
Yeah, I think we're at the point now where we are two nations within a nation, and it raises some interesting questions as to where it goes next. I mean, I know the word secession is a dirty word to a lot of people, but I would just ask people to consider, on the 4th of July, on Independence Day, that's exactly what you're separating, was there came a point where the colonists, acting on moral truth and on, you know, principles of good government, separated themselves from their mother government and declared that they would govern themselves from that point on. If it could happen once, I'm just suggesting it could potentially happen again. And I'd much rather see something like that than a bloody civil war like we saw play out in Yugoslavia 25, 30 years ago.
One of my favorite speeches from a person during the Civil War. You know, because there's a lot of controversy. A lot of people look at it as the Northern aggression. A lot of people think Lincoln did the right thing at that point. But on March 24th, 1859, a leading statesman who would soon find himself fighting in the Civil War gave a speech titled State Rights. In it, he warned of federalism, usurpation, the state sovereignty on the issue of slavery, and urged states to nullify national laws that threaten their autonomy. The speaker was not Robert E. Lee, Jefferson Davis, or another Confederate statesman. It was Charles Schultz, S-C-H-U-R-Z, a leading abolitionist who was opposed to slavery. But he was terrified that if we forced beliefs on what he believed, on everybody else, that it would be bad. He ended up fighting in the Union Army, was a general. And he fought the war, but later hated the fact that he fought in the Civil War because he thought the South actually had a right to leave because it was a compact. In his own speech, he was against Lincoln. He goes, I'm against slavery 100%. Never owned a slave. Nobody in my family's ever owned a slave. But it's not for me to tell these people what to do, since slavery existed in almost every nation in the world. And even the founding fathers, if you look at the Anti-Federalist Papers, were opposed to slavery. The Anti-Federalists were. One of their papers, I think it's like 17, was opposed to slavery in the Constitution. They wanted it put in, but they felt the compromise between them was it was too early and it would have caused the divide, and all the states wouldn't have ratified it.
No, it's interesting. You know, I know a lot of people get very upset whenever, you know, the Civil War is brought up. They want to fight it again. Like, didn't we settle this once? But it's fascinating to consider that there could have been wrong and right on both sides. The South was wrong to the extent that it wanted to preserve slavery. But like you, I agree. They were absolutely within their right to peacefully leave the Union and go their own way. And the Union, while, you know, it didn't happen until later in the war, became about let's emancipate the slaves. I think they were wrong in trying to force the South to remain against its will.
Well, and the fact of the matter was, the North actually wanted the slaves freed, but they didn't want to give him the vote. See, the South at that time was lobbying for every slave to be worth one third of a vote. And if that would have happened, then the North would have been outvoted on everything, because if the slaves had one third of a vote, every three slave would have generated another member of Congress. And the North was terrified that slaves would gain the right to vote. It was not. And it was also terrified because of the cotton industries and everything else. They didn't want them to leave and sell their cotton to another nation. So there was a lot more involved in it than just slavery. When you look at slavery as an issue, the South actually wanted to concede and make him a third of a person. The North didn't want him a person at all. They just wanted him free. But they didn't want him to have the right to vote or speak. They just wanted the South not to have that right. And most people don't realize that fact.
I would recommend anything by Lysander Spooner if you want to try something just a little bit different. He was an abolitionist. He was absolutely diehard against slavery. He also was a very fierce critic of Abraham Lincoln. And he contended that the way the Civil War, as we called it, played out, it essentially stopped chattel slavery, but reduced everyone who didn't want to live under a particular system of government to slaves. So nothing was really won in the end.
It's really funny because under his speech, they have an old sign that was hung up in Boston, one of the northern countries, and it said, "Caution, colored people of Boston, one and all, you are respectfully cautioned not to talk to police officers of Boston," because you were free there, but you weren't basically a free person. And it's just interesting to me is that there was a lot more involved. And yes, the Civil War did lead to Lincoln freeing the slaves. And it made America a better place. Some of the outcomes were good. And what would have happened if the North and South divided? Would America have been the same America it is today? Who's to know? But you can't argue Lincoln was one of the first to severely violate the compact. And that's when politicians of today look and say, well, if Lincoln could do it, then it's a contract and they had to stay. But it wasn't. When Rhode Island, New York and Virginia signed the Constitution, ratified the Constitution, they put it in their own Constitution that they joined willingly and had the right to leave willingly. Every other state assumed their same rights. And Lincoln violated that at that time. And I think our government today would violate that if it truly tried to happen with Texas or another conservative state. I wish I could say Utah, but I can't.
I'm kind of wishing sometimes we'd dust off the 10th Amendment and see if there's still some backbone out there for telling the federal government from the state level that's enough. You know, the state government interposes itself between its citizenry and a federal government that apparently doesn't recognize limits on its power.
And that's the funny thing, because if you look at the Anti-Federalist Papers and the debate that's happened in the Constitutional Convention, which this show's about, is trying to get you to educate yourself. A lot of the talk was, okay, we're going to give certain enumerated powers to the government. But if they try to exceed those, the states just have a right to say no. But the federal government also had the right to tell the states no if the states were doing something that violated the people's right. So, and that was what the Supreme Court was for. If a citizen of a state could not get a fair shot or a fair trial with their own state, they could take it to the Supreme Court. But the fact of the matter is, it was all meant to be where the federal government could tell the states, no, you are taking the power away from the people where it belongs, and the state to tell the federal government, no, you're taking it away from my people where it don't belong. And nobody does that anymore.
No, it would be interesting to see how different tone our society would take if we focused on limiting government power. But instead, it's like we're running the opposite direction to politicize and make everything possible a government matter. And somehow it just keeps dividing us. Imagine that.
Well, and that's what I say. We allow media to separate us among race, division. They love making these Black History Month and all these separate groups, you know, they're allowed. I saw the perfect meme today. They can have black only colleges. They can have black only clubs. But if you tried to do it, if you're a white person, then you're a racist. So there is such a thing as reverse racism, but nobody calls it out because they're going to be vilified. Here on America Out Loud, though, we will, because freedom is freedom for everybody. And stupid people have a right to be stupid people. And what I love about the founders, and especially the anti-federalists, which would be Madison and Patrick Henry and Benjamin Franklin, were all anti-federalists, which many people wouldn't put them in that category. They were opposed to the federal government. If it wasn't for that great compromise, we wouldn't have had the Bill of Rights. The Constitution would have been totally left to interpretation. And right now it's left to interpretation. It's incorrect interpretation because nobody researches their history anymore. And news media and politicians of today want us to forget history. And that's what's really, truly terrifying to me is are we going to forget history? Or are we going to learn it? And the Constitution is such, to me, a sacred document. I truly believe it was created by the hand of God through imperfect men. You can tell they're imperfect because they didn't agree. And he knew that he had to have two sides, two different opinions, and they had to come up with a compromise. That's why they prayed. That's why Benjamin Franklin told them to stop it, settle down, pray for their answers. Yet everybody today wants to take God out of the equation. And when we take God out of the equation, we lose the one document and the unalienable rights that come from God. Then it comes from man, and man can override anything we do.
Yeah, I think this is one of the reasons why the most authoritarian and totalitarian governments you'll ever read about were ruthless about eliminating churches, or at least the free exercise of religion in their societies. Why? Because those churches and those religions posed a competing moral authority to that of the state. And when you really want to be in control, you can have no competing moral authority.
So we're here. And the reason I wanted to do this segment of Viewpoint and have the guest I had today is because we're urging you to get educated. That's what America Out Loud's about. Every one of the guests, every one of the hosts, we all have different philosophies. We all disagree with each other, but we do it in adult conversation. But you need to get educated yourself. I want you to share this show if you learned anything from it. Share it with other people. Comment on it. Talk about it. Tell what you'd like me to talk about on the Constitution next time. Tell me what type of guest you want. Become involved. That's what America Out Loud's about. And that's why we do this. This is why I do this. Because I at one time thought I could change the world. Brian, did you ever think you could change the world on the radio?
I still believe it.
Well, okay. I've gotten a little more disheartened because I can't change the world without you. And I think Brian recognizes that, and he's nodding his head, that you need to get involved. You need to research what I've researched. Don't listen to media. Sure, Hillsdale College, like we said, Wall Builders, all these people are great people. You know, there's a lot of great people in the world talking about this stuff, but verify facts. And that's what we don't do in this world anymore. We see it on social media and we believe it to be true. Thank you for turning in this week to Viewpoint, and share this show, share the Constitution, talk about it, have conversations. Ask your friends if they know the Anti-Federalist Papers. Ask them if they even know what founding fathers were included among the Anti-Federalists. Look up Sherman. Look up Patrick Henry's speeches. Look up their letters that they wrote to each other and to Thomas Jefferson. John Adams and Thomas Jefferson played a critical role, but if Madison and Patrick Henry and Sherman and these others weren't there to balance it out, America wouldn't have lasted 10 years. And that's my belief. Until next Sunday, see ya.